Good afternoon, everyone. The Labor, Industry, Veterans, Military Affairs, Finance, and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Chair Eklund?
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang?
Present.
Representative Detmer?
Detmer, present.
Representative McDonald?
Donald, present. I'm not a dog.
Representative Berg?
Present.
Representative Bliss?
Present.
Representative Edelson?
Present.
Representative Frederick? Representative Frederick? Representative Greenman? Representative Nelson?
Present. You're muted, Ms. Doyle. There you go.
Representative Raleigh?
Is barking appropriate?
Sorry. Raleigh, present. Representative yes. Sundin? Representative Sundin? We do have a quorum. I'm very sorry.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. Quorum is present and the joys of Zoom. Let's... Next on the agenda is approval of the minutes from the March 12, 2021 meeting. Every member should have received a copy of today's minutes in their inbox. Representative Zhang, would you care to move the minutes?
So moved, Chair.
Vice Chair Zhang moves approval of the minutes. Any questions or comments or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the minutes, say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. The minutes are adopted. We have one bill on the agenda today, House File 1200 from Representative Richardson. Two committees in a row, Chair Richardson. It's good to see you again on such short notice. I will move that House File 1200 be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Welcome, Ms. Chair Richardson. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1200 would create a statewide paid family and medical leave insurance benefit program. The program is modeled after our state's unemployment insurance benefit program and would provide a much needed safety net for families. At some point, the majority of workers will need to take some time away from work to care for a new child, a family member that is sick, or to recover themselves from illness. Caring for others and receiving care is a key component of being human and living a fulfilling life. Unfortunately, the reality for the majority of Minnesotans is that it's not that simple. Only about 13% of the Minnesota workforce has paid family leave through an employer, and an estimated 44% have access through an employer-provided temporary disability program. The lack of access demonstrates structural inequality. The majority of Minnesotan workers are excluded. Those who are currently left out of paid family and medical leave programs are often those who need the access the most and are facing the most economic insecurity. Lower paid employees are disproportionately left out of paid family leave programs. Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and other workers of color are also less likely to have access. And women are also facing disparities when it comes to access to paid family leave programs. Most Minnesotan workers cannot afford to take time off without pay. Without access to wage replacement, workers with serious health conditions put off treatment or return to work sooner than recommended, jeopardizing recovery and long-term health. Unfortunately, there's a legacy in this country of inequities and occupational segregation that has resulted in uneven safety nets. In fact, when the Social Security Act passed, there were exemptions that did not allow farmers or domestics to participate, and as a result, 65% of Black people across the country were ineligible for benefits. Today in Minnesota, we see inequities in who has access to the safety net of paid family and medical leave and those who do not. The current system serves to deepen unacceptable disparities and inequality in the state. The holes in the safety net are so large, the majority of our hardworking and lowest income Minnesota families are falling through. The key to this bill is that it would ensure that the vast majority of hardworking Minnesotans will not be placed in the impossible choice of caring for themselves, a loved one, or a paycheck. A serious illness or injury can devastate a family's economic security quickly, as many Minnesotans are only one, two, or a few paychecks away from financial disaster. In the midst of a global pandemic, it has become even more clear. Illness can strike at any time, and families, just like businesses, need safety nets. The National Partnership for Women and Families has conducted national surveys on paid family leave, and in the most recent survey, 8 in 10 voters and overall 84% of voters support permanent paid family and medical leave. A state-operated paid family and medical leave insurance program has the potential to improve economic stability and health outcomes. In the U.S., nearly one-third of women who give birth do not take any maternity leave, and one in four women return to work within 2 weeks of giving birth. Paid leave matters for child health and development. Women who have access to paid leave are 93% more likely to be in the workforce in 9 to 12 months after a child's birth than women who take no leave. For women who do not have access to this leave, the study found that nearly 30% will drop out of the workforce within a year of welcoming a child, and one in five will not return for over a decade. Working families with paid leave are more economically secure and significantly less likely to use public support programs in the year after a child's birth. Employers benefit through increased employee retention, reduced turnover, and increased loyalty and morale. Paid leave boosts labor force participation. It is a component of an economic policy lever. Minnesotans want to work and take care of their families, and this bill can help make that a reality. We also have the added benefit and ability to take advantage of lessons learned from other states that have implemented similar programs that have proven effective, beneficial, and sustainable, even in the midst of the COVID pandemic. I have some author testifiers and would request Mr. Chair recognize Deb Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. First up on the, and we've got a series of testifiers, so I'll name off the first three. First up would be Deborah Fitzpatrick, second, Mary Jo Malechka, and third, Lauren Schotthorst. Deborah Fitzpatrick, Policy and Legislative Affairs Director, Children's Defense Fund of Minnesota. Ms. Fitzpatrick, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I am currently the Policy and Legislative Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund. I'd like to share a few screens or a few slides with you today just to kind of ground the committee in the policy. I am here today as a former lead researcher for the legislatively mandated study on paid family and medical leave implementation and design. It was conducted originally in 2016 and then updated in 2019. So important to note that this policy is grounded in that research as well as the experience of other states and the experience of our own infrastructure within UI and other state programs. So this program is designed as a social contributory social insurance program, and that is the dominant model that is used in 8 U.S. states and most countries around the world. And what that means is just that employers and workers are both contributing to a state fund based on their wages, and that amounts to around the, for a median worker in the state earning $52,000 a year, that's about $3 per week that they're contributing, and their employer match could match that or would match that. There's a couple of exceptions. Employers with comparable benefit programs can provide their own program, and self-employed and contractors can choose to join the program. Eligibility for the program is based on attachment to the workforce and earnings, plus a need for leave. And healthcare providers for most types of leave certify that need for leave, and then the worker is making a claim on that state fund for the support they need while they're on leave. And as Representative Richardson mentioned, House File 1200 builds on many unemployment insurance definitions, and that is done to reduce employer burdens and also to help us ensure a successful build out of a new state program. There's a lot of reasons that social insurance is the dominant model for these types of programs, again, in most of the United States that have done this and the world. I think the most important one, recognizing the way our economy has evolved, is that it's a portable benefit. It's not attached to a specific job or employer. Workers, as we mentioned, receive their support from the state fund during the leave. And as we know, many workers work multiple jobs either successively or at the same time, and this type of portable benefit makes sure that they're able to access the full extent of their earnings. And also, as we have talked about during COVID, lots of lessons learned about some of the challenges with having insurance attached to employment. The next thing is it creates the broadest possible risk pool, and that keeps the costs very low for all. And in this bill, we're splitting those low costs equally between workers and employers. And this type of approach creates a level benefits playing field. Several types of equity have already been mentioned, but geography is another one that we haven't talked a lot about. Rural employers and rural workers are less likely to have access to leave now. And so this has the effect of leveling, again, that the benefits playing field between large employers, small employers, also between employers based on the need of leave their workers have. Right now, the system really requires those employers with workers that need leave or have disproportionately have workers with need to take the leave, that falls completely on them. And then finally, this approach is really durable and popular because everyone is paying into it, contributing. It's an earned benefit, and then everyone has the opportunity to have that kind of support when their time comes, when they need it. Just briefly want to run through the benefit structure, and then I can take questions later. We can go to other testifiers. House File 1200 provides partial wage replacement during leaves of at least 7 days. I think that's an important thing to note. This is really designed to pick up where an average number of sick days that most workers earn have been exhausted. So this is for those longer term needs. It's up to 12 weeks per year for a worker's own serious health condition, and up to 12 weeks per year for a care of a family member. And I wanted to mention, given this committee's purview, that this particular bucket of leave also applies to foreign deployments or active military service and the needs that family members might have around those types of leaves. Employment protections is the right to be reinstated into your job after a leave, and continued health insurance benefits. Eligibility for those employment protections starts 90 days after an employee is hired, so those don't kick in immediately. And then finally, I just wanted to highlight the data from other state programs and the U.S. Department of Labor shows that most workers often use fewer weeks than the maximum allowed, and the vast majority of workers use the program or take a leave only one time, many times over multiple years. So with that, I will stop, and we can do other testifiers, and I'm happy to answer detailed questions later as necessary. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. Next up is Mary Jo Malecha. Ms. Malecha, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Eklund and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Mary Jo Malecha. I live in New Brighton, and I'm a leader with ISAAH. I've lived with type 1 diabetes since I was diagnosed at age 11. When I became pregnant with my first child at age 24, I was thrilled. It was considered a high-risk pregnancy, and at 20 weeks, I started to have preterm labor, which was controlled with medication. At 36 weeks, My blood pressure spiked, and my doctor told me I could no longer work. I needed to spend the rest of my pregnancy on bed rest. 1 week later, my doctor decided it was too dangerous for the baby and for me to continue the pregnancy, so they performed a cesarean. The baby was healthy, I was doing well, and the doctor told me that I would be ready to go back to work at 8 weeks postpartum, barring any complications. Sadly, my employers, when informed of this great news, told me that I needed to be back at work 5 weeks postpartum because I had, in essence, started my allotted 6-week maternity leave when I left the company to be on bed rest. I told them that my doctor advised against returning to work 5 weeks after major surgery. It would put my health as a type 1 diabetic in a precarious situation. I pleaded with my employers to let me extend my maternity leave to 8 weeks postpartum, which would be 9 weeks total. They refused. I asked point blank, if I don't come back to work at 5 weeks postpartum, will I be fired? Yes, they said. Even though the financial ramifications for my young family were severe, I did not return after 5 weeks, and I was fired. Just to be clear, in this case, we were not even talking about paid maternity leave. We were talking about unpaid leave. I never would have believed that 36 years ago, what happened to me would still be happening to women. Unfortunately, it still is. Women in Minnesota are being told they need to get back to work just weeks after giving birth, or they will lose their jobs. It's time for paid family and medical leave to be passed, and I encourage you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Malika, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name. Next up is Lauren Schotthorst, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Ms. Schotthorst, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
For the record, my name is Lauren Schotthorst, and I'm the Director of Workplace Management and Workforce Development at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm speaking today representing the Chamber's 6,300 businesses and 500,000 employees, and also on behalf of the Chamber Federation, which represents more than 43 local chambers and 21,000 businesses, the Minnesota Manufacturers Coalition, which represents a wide range of individual manufacturing associations across the state, and the United for Jobs Coalition, which represents nearly 80 organizations and their hundreds of thousands of employees in opposition to House File 1200. In light of time constraints, I have submitted full remarks as written testimony and a one-page document co-signed by the coalition members I just mentioned. With that, I will begin my testimony. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am testifying today to reiterate the top message we have shared with the legislature on behalf of the Minnesota business community. Minnesota's economic recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic must be the top priority for this session. We oppose attempts to impose unworkable one-size-fits-all paid leave mandates because of the variety and nuances of many workplaces across Minnesota. With massive pandemic-driven changes to work rules and conditions, state-driven cost burdens matter all the more. Minnesota employers provide employees with innovative and robust benefits, promoting wellness and flexibility while maintaining the ability to operate safely and manage a variety of workplaces across the state. Employers in our state currently must also adhere to a strict set of labor laws and workplace standards at all levels of government in order to maintain safe, healthy, respectful, and inclusive workplaces. Within the current regulatory regime, employers must have the autonomy to make staffing decisions and provide wages, benefits, and schedules that are appropriate for their workplace and responsive to workplace needs. House File 1200 places a new payroll tax on every employer to create a broad new state-run insurance program that will collectively cost the Minnesota business community $2.2 billion over its first 3 years. In addition to the direct cost on employers, the proposal will, conservatively, take years of development and hundreds of state full-time employees to start, implement, and administrate at a time when state agencies are completely overleveraged due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Most importantly, this proposal creates a mechanism for an employee to be away from their job for up to 24 weeks each year. That's 44% of a working year. Furthermore, this bill requires employers to maintain specific records in a specific format or risk significant fines and liabilities for a set of benefits that a majority of our members are already offering their employees in some form. In a time of economic recovery, the Chamber and its partners support a do-no-harm approach that limits additional cost burdens and mandates on employers, particularly small employers, who are doing their best to keep their doors open and Minnesotans employed. For these reasons, we respectfully encourage a no vote on House File 1200 and appreciate the opportunity to share our opposition with the committee today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Shothorst. Next up is Julie Noren, co-owner of Light Dark Landscaping Minneapolis. Ms. Noren, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Julie Noren. I co-own Light Dark Landscape in Minneapolis, and I'm a member of Main Street Alliance. We are a small company that designs and installs landscapes with an emphasis on sustainable solutions and Minnesota native species. My business partner and I work year-round with 4 to 5 seasonal employees joining us during our busy season. Like everyone else, our crew has faced its share of major life events, pregnancies, sick children, long-term injuries, that are both typical and singularly important times. Unfortunately, with rare exceptions, we can't afford to cover extended paid leave on a regular basis, especially since one of the times we did, the funds we saved for the leave were heavily taxed that year because they looked like extra profit that we left sitting in the bank. During the pandemic, the Federal CARES Act offered a temporary solution for us to support our employees and keep our business running. It provided tax credits so we could pay full wages to our employees while they quarantined at home, ensuring that the rest of us could reduce exposure to COVID-19 and keep the work moving forward. There's no reason the goals of the CARES Act, to keep business going while allowing for periods of time to focus on health and family, only apply to pandemic times. Small businesses like mine employ nearly half of the U.S. workforce, but we cannot bear the cost of supporting families alone. We need the scale and authority of government to create a paid family and medical leave fund that we and our employees pay into incrementally. Not unlike unemployment insurance, a plan like this would allow us to plan for and provide access to financial support for employees, as well as business owners temporarily called away by health and family demands. A national poll showed that nearly 2/3 of small business owners across the country support a paid leave policy. Among other benefits, it provides peace of mind that small business owners and employees don't have to choose between their health and their livelihoods. To build a more sustainable American future, we need a state-backed, shared responsibility paid family leave program to be a part of the new normal. Please support House File 1200. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Noreen. Next up is Kimberly Dunn-Lewis, Minnesota School Board Association. Ms. Lewis, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Kimberly Lewis, and I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent all 333 school boards across Minnesota. As well as this afternoon, I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Those two folks are all the superintendents across Minnesota, and the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. They are the ones that are the financial brains behind the districts. And Schools for Equity in Education. We appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts with you on House File 1200. Our board's administration, in particular our school district business officials and human resource reps, have significant concerns over this proposal. And the concerns relate to how it's implemented and the management of it. As with last year's House File 5, our folks in those positions alerted us to 3 major concerns. Our primary concern is the cost to schools. School boards do not have the authority to levy funds that would be needed to cover the employee portion of this bill. In other words, we'd have to pull the money out of the general fund, which would mean pulling it out of the classroom. In addition, when employees are out, districts must hire substitute teachers or substitute paraprofessionals. That would be another direct cost to the outcome of this bill. Since we don't produce a widget per se, we can't increase our prices. So the funds come out of the general fund again, and in other words, the classroom. There's also the soft cost of administration and reporting of the program at the district level. And at a time when most schools in Minnesota are experiencing budget deficits and making cuts, especially in the midst of the pandemic and the aftermath of that, we really wonder how schools are to pay for this benefit. Another question is how collective bargaining would be impacted. If passed, would this be a statewide benefit that would be part of local bargaining negotiations, or would it supersede negotiations, or somehow both? We don't know how it would align with the currently negotiated time paid time off that are in several collective bargaining agreements for several reasons of leave. And something that's problematic and we ask the author to consider is the July 1st, 2021 effective date. This date is in the middle of our teachers' collective bargaining agreement that would go from 2021 to 2023. And finally, as I mentioned just briefly, due to the nature of the workforce within our schools, there may be a potential for a greater need of substitutes. With up to 12 weeks for an illness or 12 weeks for bonding, an employee could possibly be out of the classroom for up to 24 weeks of the school year, or longer if they use their accrued vacation or sick time. If this were the case, again, our HR representatives who struggle now to hire subs, we have one school district that is down 73 classrooms in substitute. They're begging for subs. We wonder how we'd find an adequate number of highly qualified substitutes and other support professionals, and what strain that would have on our budgets. It's our responsibility to keep high quality teachers and paraprofessionals, et cetera, in front of our students. We'd like to continue conversations, but we wanted to bring those points to your attention, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Next up is Beverly Tinney, a paraeducator. Ms. Tinney, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Eklund and members of the committee. My name is Beverly Tinney, and I'm a special education paraeducator. Currently, I'm on leave, and I'm working with support paras and bus drivers and food service workers and others in my union, which is SEIU Local 284. Our union consists of 8,000 hourly workers in the schools, a majority of whom are women and people of color. Our work, which we love doing, is caring for others, but we also want to be able to care for our loved ones. Often, we are unpaid caregivers, whether it's for our children or our parents when they get older or other loved ones with medical issues. In fact, one woman who is going to testify here today, a member, was not able to make it because she's currently home taking care of her 93-year-old mother. As hourly workers, many of us are like a vast majority of Minnesotans who sadly just get used to not having paid time to be with loved ones. If we have an aging parent who needs help, we have to work it around our work hours. If a child gets sick, if you're one of the lucky ones, then you can juggle who can be with them. It doesn't have to be this way. We can have policies that put the health, safety, and well-being of our families first. I'm here today fully in support of this bill because our union believes that every family in Minnesota, no matter our race, wealth, job, or zip code, should have paid family and medical leave. We really shouldn't have to choose between caring for our loved ones and getting a paycheck. In Minnesota, we care for each other. But when 75% of people don't have access to paid time to care, are we truly living up to those values? Passing this bill would also help to address the terrible racial disparities that continue to hurt our state. I spent hundreds of hours this election cycle talking to voters, and I can tell you that Minnesotans across party lines, across race and in every corner of our state, want our leaders to pass things like paid family and medical leave. They know the wealth in our state and want our leaders to be bold and pass laws that help all of us, with no exception, help all of us to thrive. There is enough for all of us, but we need you all to take action and take that action now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tinney. Last testifier is Professor Amy Egret. Professor, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Amy Egret, and I'm with Isaiah, and I am an adjunct professor for Southern New Hampshire University. Excuse me. Paid family and medical leave, I believe, is essential for Minnesota families. When I was pregnant with my first child, I applied for short-term disability through my employer, and because of my pre-existing condition of migraines, I was denied. My challenges were many: migraines, bed rest, a premature baby with jaundice, postpartum depression, an infection the first week after delivery, and major surgery 6 weeks after delivery. I was fortunate to have support systems that other families do not have. I had loving family that supported us. Therefore, I was able to take the full 12 weeks to care for and bond with my baby, recover, and go back to work for my employer. Yes, I had my mother to help me with the house so that I could be the best mom to an infant that I could be with the challenges I had. Some people say that is what new moms should do, rely on family and friends. But what about mothers that do not have that safety net of family and friends? As the Family Medical Leave Act coordinator at my workplace for a company with several thousand employees, I was always stunned to talk to mothers who couldn't afford to take much time off from medical leave after having a child. Usually these were single moms and they didn't have a choice. And I wondered how focused could they be on their work when they're thinking about their children. So paid family and medical leave makes it possible for moms and dads in Minnesota across race, class, and geography to not worry about where their next meal is coming from and how to pay the bills so they can lovingly bond with their newborns. It also levels the playing field for small businesses with the large corporations that already offer this benefit. Paid family and medical leave will help get the newest Minnesotans off to a stronger, safer, and healthier start in life. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Eggert. I appreciate your testimony. We have several member questions. Chair Richardson, is that it for your testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Just want to make sure. First up, Representative McDonald.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions here. So excuse me while I pull up this question. Say, a question for Representative Richardson. In regards to the bill that requires a brand new built from the ground IT software and in sets a short amount of time, I'm wondering why would you put that short amount of time and bring up from the ground level the new program, which the department said they weren't able to do in such a short amount of time, knowing the failures, unfortunately, that happened with MINIT and MinLARS.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald, for the question. For clarity, what we are proposing here is to build on the existing infrastructure within the unemployment insurance program, so it would not be building from the ground up. And I think that there have been a lot of lessons learned over the past several years from other states that have set up similar programs. And I think that with the COVID pandemic, the state was also in a position with the pandemic unemployment insurance to have to respond very quickly. And Minnesota was, in fact, one of the first in the nation to get the pandemic unemployment insurance up and running. And so, you know, the department may have more to say on this issue, but I know that there's been a lot of conversation happening with other states that have focused on this model of not starting from the ground up, but really building on existing policies, procedures, and infrastructure within the unemployment realm.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I hope that this the case, Mrs. Representative Richardson. I just have to be blunt. I have folks, many folks from my district that call me that have grave concerns on your bill. I do as well, especially during these times of economic and during the pandemic. It's a very, very costly bill as I read through it, but I have not yet seen a fiscal note. But I do know that the cost to the businesses is instrumental and will be so during this tough time. Have you established a fiscal note? I'd like to see kind of the number on that in conjunction of the whole bill.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the thank you, Representative McDonald, for the question as well. The appropriations that would be relevant to this committee in fiscal year 2020, there's $528,000 from the general fund to the Department of Labor and Industry as a one-time appropriation. There is a appropriation in fiscal year 2023 of $518,000. Fiscal year 2024, and I should be clear that that 23 fiscal year appropriation is from the benefit insurance account, and there are similar appropriations from the benefit insurance account in fiscal year 2024 of $468,000 and $618,000 in fiscal year 2025. So in terms of the Department of Labor and Industry, those are the appropriations that are set forth. And I appreciate you raising up the issue about the challenges within the pandemic, because I think the pandemic has laid clear a lot of the challenges, a lot of the disparities that we continue to see. And just as we have had to be responsive to businesses with payroll protection loans, this is also ensuring that the people who power businesses are going to be afforded a safety net right now as well, because our employees, when they are facing illness or sickness or accidents, they need a safety net as well.
Representative Donald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Fredrickson. Well, yes, you make some very good points, and they do have safety nets between the federal and the state FMLA. What is it? Our program RE for paid family sick leave. That's the acronym on there. Excuse me. Right? The FLMA. Is that what it is? Yeah, FMLA. So we already do have programs for the safety net, which is a great thing. We must take care of our employees. Employers must do that, and they certainly do. This certainly will put an undue burden and expense on them. At one point, do we want to thank our employers for the work that they do, the taxes they pay, the people they hire, and taking care of them immensely? This is just another very expensive program, at least what I see and what I'm hearing. Maybe you can convince me otherwise, and I'm open to listening. Of course, I am. But and at the end, the consumers will have to pay this. You know, the bill that we had right before, was it this? Yeah, the child care in taxes, I guess we had a bill for child care tax credit because the cost of child care is so expensive. And with your bill, that'll certainly make child care even more expensive because of the tax. But just wondering, Mr. Chair, when we can get that information regarding the fiscal note. I think that'd be important. It's a big bill. It'd be good to know. And I think we, all of us members should have access to that.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, members, the fiscal note has been requested by the Workforce Development Committee, and it is due on Friday. So we should see hopefully something by then. But I would just echo what Representative Richardson said, that in this case, there are appropriations in the bill. And so that at this point would be the cost to those agencies.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, I know there's other members, I'm sure, that wants to ask questions, so I won't hog up the time of the committee. I do have one, I won't say my last question, but last question in this section. I was on the phone with a couple of employers regarding the workforce, housing workforce, and we brought up wage reporting, wage theft, and the bills, the laws that the state have. So I got a question with Representative Richardson regarding Section 17. With explaining, if you could explain the new wage reporting mandates on all employers and why that burden is being thrust on employees who are struggling to survive.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Chair Eklund and Representative McDonald, for the question. And one thing that I do just want to make clear and clarify around the Family Medical Leave Act, or FMLA, is FMLA is unpaid leave, so it is not the same thing as this bill sets forth in terms of paid family medical leave. And it's also really important to understand that within FMLA, there are many families who do not have access access to who do not have access to FMLA. And so just want to make that clear around the difference between this bill and when we're talking about FMLA. And so in terms of the reporting requirements within this bill, there are requirements much like we see in terms of what's required with the wage theft bill, that there be disclosures to employees so that they understand what is available to them. And I am also happy to have Ms. Fitzpatrick elaborate on that as well, but it's really about ensuring that we're tracking what would be available for the employees.
McDonald, you want Ms. Fitzpatrick to comment?
I do, Mr. Chair.
I can't get your name right. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Representative McDonald, the wage reporting, the section of the bill that you are referencing, that wage reporting detail is exactly the same as under the unemployment insurance system. So the same set of employers that are reporting that wage detail, this is really just cloning that same reporting that's already occurring. So it would just be sending the exact same report to this program as well as UI.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. Fine Irish name you got there. And I'm glad you explained that because I have a bill that I'm hoping Mr. Chairman will give it a hearing. I'm going to request one. I think I did it already, but I'll talk to it offline. That actually cleans up a little bit of the language with that those reportings. Whereas right now under state law, it will penalize an employer for a mistake, a human mistake. We're all humans. We all make mistakes. And under this particular bill that Ms. Representative Richardson has, like state law, it penalizes unfairly employers should they mistype or not dot an I or cross a line of a T. So I think that's a grave concern that we allow some flexibility for employers and not just assume right away that they're being fraudulent and slap them with penalties and fees on top of the very expensive bill. So that's my comment on that. If you'd like to comment, Ms. Fitzpatrick, that's fine. If not, we can move along. Mr. Chair, I'm sure you want to go move along.
Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I think the idea here is to try to make this as seamless as possible for employers. So I think if the state legislature were to decide to make some changes to that wage detail, I think we would want to mirror that within this program. I think that's the goal.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Fitzpatrick, just to play on the words, if we wanted to make this as seamless as possible for employers, we probably shouldn't pass this bill. No offense, Representative Richardson, sorry, Representative. All right, that's all I got for now, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it very much. Representative Richardson, I've been in the IT space and designing large non-monolithic systems for about the last 20 years, specifically on the financial transaction systems as it deals with either commerce or e-commerce or things along that line. And I want to make sure that I understood what you told Representative McDonald. My question is, does a computer program or system currently exist that's capable of administering this multi-billion dollar program? And I want to make sure that I understood that what you told Representative McDonald.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Raleigh, for the question. So the intent of the bill is that the infrastructure would be built upon the unemployment insurance program that we currently have. So that is a infrastructure that currently exists. It's been in existence for quite a while, And it's also worked very well, as I had stated with the question that Representative McDonald put forward. We saw that when it was time for that system to go undergo some changes as it related to the pandemic unemployment insurance program, Minnesota was one of the first in the nation that was able to accomplish that in order to start helping to support individuals who had lost employment. And I think there's also an opportunity, I don't know if the department wants to talk more about this, but there's been a lot of conversation that has happened around sort of the build out in terms of relying on the unemployment infrastructure for this. It's similar to the way that the system was built out in Washington. And there have been a number of conversations that have been had with Washington in terms of looking at that build out of that model, not only with the department, but also several representatives as well, as this is not the first time that this bill is being heard. So there's been a lot of conversation around the IT infrastructure, and Representative Elkins has been a real leader in terms of looking at the IT infrastructure pieces of the bill.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as the data modeling is concerned, there is a lot of additional data points that are being asked for in this bill, specifically a look back to the highest peak of earning as over time. And I believe that there's at least a one-year look back on employment. Typically, when you're designing a multimodal system like this, where you've got multiple data points coming in from literally tens of thousands of employers, how is it that you're going to be able to implement this by January 1st, 2024, and have RFPs or RFIs been currently released to the private sector to start building this? Or what's been that process so far?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Raleigh, for the question. And so in terms of the timeline, again, we have the ability to have some lessons learned from some other states as well. And the process and the timeline that is within the bill also reflects the process and the timeline that was used within the within the state of Washington, within their program as well. Washington had their program actually go live right in the midst of the COVID pandemic, and what they were able to do is actually respond to more requests than they had anticipated. And they also were able to, at the end of the year, have a program that proved to be sustainable within even the challenges that were many related to the COVID pandemic as well. And so, again, this is really using some lessons learned from other states in terms of the way that the infrastructure and the timing of the programming within the bill has been laid out. And Mr. Chair, I think that Ms. Fitzpatrick may have a comment here as well.
Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Chair Eklund, Representative Raleigh. Actually, the answer to this question kind of piggybacks off the question that Representative McDonald raised. The situation that you described is exactly what happens under UI now when they're using those wage detail reports to look back over the last four to five quarters to see what the earnings have been. So this is a great example, actually, of how building on the UI system is going to make a lot of sense for us and be, again, I'll use that term seamless again, but the way that we are able to, again, build these systems to be very parallel so that we are able to use those IT infrastructures that are already in place.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I've got a couple questions that should be pretty fast. We're looking at about $2.2 billion. One of the testifiers stated that's what we're looking at for this particular new tax increase. How many new FTEs will this project or will this this new tax add to the roles in Minnesota?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Raleigh, for the question. And I know that we are currently waiting for a fiscal note, and so that I think is going to be really important to get the information and the data and the costs from the department as we look at this moving forward. There are some estimates that have been put together in terms of looking at the staffing pieces related to the program and building up to the program, and if memory serves correctly, that would be adding additional staffing up to about 300 people. And Ms. Fitzpatrick, you may have other comments.
Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Sorry, Chair Eklund, Representative Raleigh. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but yes, that will be part of the fiscal note. But I do believe someone from the Department of Labor and Industry is on that could maybe speak to the staffing related to DLI if the committee is interested.
Do we have somebody from Department of Labor that could comment on that question? Commissioner Wissenbach.
Yes, hi. Hi, Chair Eklund. Nicole Blissenbach, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. As was mentioned earlier, our fiscal note is in process of being submitted right now. It should be finalized by the due date on at the end of this week. If looking at the what was submitted in prior years, it's going to be approximately, for the Department of Labor and Industry, approximately 4.7 FTE, I think, is what we had thought in prior years. The Department of Labor and Industry is only responsible for certain portions of the bill, including the employment protections. So those additional FTE will be dedicated to that.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I want to make sure that I heard that. 4.7 and 300? I want to make sure that I heard that. This may add up to 300 FTEs. Was that what I heard? And then I heard 4.7, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Blissenbach.
Yes, thank you, Chair and Representative Raleigh. I was only speaking to the employees that would be required at the Department of Labor and Industry for the portion of the bill that we are responsible for. Those would include the employment protections. So we would need an additional approximately 4 FTEs, still waiting on the final fiscal note approval that will be done by the end of this week.
Representative Raleigh.
Then, Mr. Chair, I'm confused. Where did the 300 come in, Mr. Chair?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Raleigh, for the question. So with House File 5, that was previously heard, there were some estimations that were put together previously. So there are currently, because the fiscal note is not done, we don't have information until that is completed, but that's based on previous fiscal notes from the bill that was heard before.
And I might, Representative Raleigh, I might want to remind folks that some of this is dealing with the UI system, so we'd have to bring in Deed there. So these questions should be better answered once we do get the fiscal note. I think Commissioner Blissenbach is pretty clear that it's about 4.7 or so, 4 point something for the staffing we needed at the Department of Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had assumed it was going to probably be around 5, and that's why I was surprised when I heard 300. I've got two more very quick questions, Mr. Chair. First of all, we heard one of the testifiers say that there are situations, specifically in collective bargaining, where through the contract that is in place, that they cannot collect these fees from union employees. I believe I'm stating this correctly. How would we address that? And then my second question, just to give you an idea of how that I'm done, what happens when an employee or employees leave Minnesota? They move to a different place. If this is going to be administered at the state level, and it is an earned benefit. If an employee leaves, or let's say they retire and they're no longer in the employment ranks, what happens when they leave the roles, Mr. Chair?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Raleigh, for the question. So in terms of looking at the ability to charge back to employees, the way that the bill is drafted, it does allow employers to charge back up to 50% or 0.3% of the costs to the employee. And that would be a question as to whether that would be something that would be potentially bargained for from a collective bargaining agreement perspective. And in terms of the way that the program works, again, we're building on the UI system, and so we would be using the same sort of processes that we would use if someone from moved to another state. In terms of how we would address that from a UI perspective, would be the same way that we would address that from a paid family medical leave perspective.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am here. But yeah, thank you. Representative Richardson, you mentioned that this is going to be monitored and run through the unemployment insurance program. Am I correct?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Detmer, for your question. The infrastructure in terms of the IT build out is going to be modeled after the unemployment insurance program.
Representative
Detmer. Yeah, Mr. Chair. So who is exactly going to be running the program? It's going to be modeled after the UI. Is DEED going to be running the program? Who is actually going to be responsible for running the program?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Detmer, for the question. So DEED would play a role in terms of the program. The Department of Labor and Industry would also have an enforcement role as part of the program, and would also be participating from a conciliation perspective as well.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And is there someone here from the UI or DEED that can talk about what their role is going to be, that kind of give us a better idea exactly how they're going to be running the program? You know, I heard this bill last year, and so it's back again this year, but I've never really had someone from the UI and from DEED to really explain how it's going to work for them.
Do we
have somebody here?
I'm checking right now, Representative Detmer. Is there somebody from DEED that could comment on this? If that's on in the committee. I don't see anybody from DEED, Representative Detmer, but we will get that question submitted to them and see if they can get the answers back to you.
Representative Detmer. Thank you, Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. They really should have been here today. You know, looking at this bill, there's three articles. It's a fairly long bill, and going through it, maybe we should have gone through article by article like we do sometimes on some of these complicated bills for us to understand. Is there someone from unemployment here that could make some comments?
So, Detmer, unemployment is administered through DEED.
Through DEED, okay, gotcha.
And
Chair Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt Representative Detmer, but in terms of thinking through sort of what the structure looks like, there would be a new department that would be established through DEED to run the program. So it would be under the umbrella of DEED.
I understand. I know that you can't use UI resources to or employees to update, you know, different things in our law. You know, you just can't do that. Whenever I look at a bill, I go to the section of the bill that has definitions, and maybe Representative Richardson could help me with the definition. If you look at Section 5 of your bill, it explains a revision definition for the serious health condition, as it went from a 10-line definition last session to a page and a half. You know, why was there such a big change in definitions on Section 5 of your bill?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Detmer, for the question that you've asked. So in terms of looking at serious health conditions, we are also including, you know, serious health conditions, things, for example, as admission into treatment for like a substance use disorder and other issues that may require leave. So there are some differences in terms of looking through those definitions, and largely in terms of what we are looking at when we're thinking about a serious health condition. We did a lot of looking at the current FMLA rules around serious health conditions as well. And so there's also some alignments around the FMLA definitions for serious health conditions.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Richardson, another definition in terms of wages on Section 5, it went from a 6-line definition last session to a 3-page definition. This is important as the bill calls for greater record keeping on behalf of the employers. What changed there? You know, there's going to be a lot of record keeping that's going to have to be part of this bill, part of this program. So, you know, big change in definition there.
Chair Richardson, Ms. James, nonpartisan staff can weigh in on some of this stuff. She's offered some explanations if you'd care to go to that. So, Ms. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Detmer, to your question about the deed administration, mm-hmm. I can provide a bit of clarity on that if it's helpful. So like Representative Richardson said, there will be a new division that's administered and part of deed. And I believe it will be separate and different than the unemployment system. The other piece is that there will be a new fund where the premiums will be paid into and the benefits will be paid out of. That's somewhat similar to the UI Trust Fund. Again, it's not the UI Trust Fund. It's not the UI system. It just is modeling some of those concepts. So again, deed would be responsible for collecting those premiums and then paying out those premiums, administering those accounts. And that would be part of this new division under deed's umbrella.
Representative Dever.
Well, thank you. And in terms of that question regarding, maybe that was part of the answer to my last question on Section 5 and the wages. It went from a 6-line definition to a 3-page definition. Anything, Representative Richardson, can you help us out on that?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Eklund, and thank you, Representative Detmer, for the question. And so, again, in terms of, you know, looking through, you know, some of the definitions, most of that is pulled from what's happening internally with the unemployment insurance program. So as Ms. James pointed out, it's really around modeling the language around the way that our UI system is currently operating.
Representative Dever.
Yeah, I'll finish up here, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson, for you've taken on a big challenge here, and I know that looking at the co-authors on your bill, you haven't brought anybody from the other side of the aisle in to work with you on this, but I've learned over the years that in order to get some good legislation through, it needs to be bipartisan. You need to work together, and it's going to be tough, but thank you for bringing the bill to the committee.
Representative Greenman.
Mr. Chair.
I apologize, Chair Richardson.
And just a point of clarification, the bill is bipartisan. We have bipartisan support within the Senate, and I am also happy to work with you, Representative Detmer, or anyone who would be interested in working on this bill together. I mean, ultimately, what it really comes down to is we have a number of families, a number of Minnesotans who are being left out of the current process, and so would be happy to work with you if you would be interested in doing that.
Representative Detmer.
I'm done.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Richardson, for bringing this bill. And I think responding to, I hear about it a lot from folks in my community, and I also have seen the polls, the 70-80% of Minnesotans and Americans want this, so just really appreciate it. One of the things I think I'm interested in talking about, and if you and your testifiers can shed light on, is the cost of not doing this. The cost, and I think we sort of alluded to it, but the cost to workers who are having to figure out how to on FMLA or figure out how to take the time they need to care for their loved ones or themselves. The cost to our families who may lose out on that caregiving, and the cost to our economy. I think you spoke to the cost of folks just having to drop out of the workforce, particularly women and parents. And so I'm wondering if there's any data that you all could share about the cost right now that this program would actually help to alleviate, because I know our fiscal notes aren't going to show those costs to workers and families in the economy, and I would love to hear if we have some thoughts on that.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Chair Eklund, and thank you, Representative Greenman, for the question. And there is data on the costs. You know, in terms of looking at low-income workers, for example, low-income workers are three times more likely to lose their job when taking leave as compared with other individuals. And when we think about individuals, you know, especially in Minnesota, who are among the ranks of low-income workers, they are often the families that don't have the safety nets. And so as a result of that, it does increase, you know, costs related to public assistance, for example, when we don't have a safety net of paid family leave that covers the lowest income workers. There's also cost savings in terms of looking at just the general overall health of the smallest Minnesotans as well, because if we have, you know, women that are going to work shortly after giving birth or within 2 weeks of giving birth, we see that there are decreases in things, for example, such as breastfeeding, and that has health consequences and also brain development consequences long-term as well. There's also data out of a number of states that have passed paid family leave in terms of being able to reduce the cost associated with long-term care, because when individuals have the ability to care for their family members outside of nursing homes, for example, that's additional cost savings, not only to the state of Minnesota, but to the federal government as well.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Richardson. And this is just sort of a follow-up in terms of how this works for Minnesotans. And I think one of your testifiers, Ms. Noren, talked about being a small business owner and wanting to provide this for her and her employees. And I'm wondering articulate how a program like this will help, particularly small businesses. So I think a lot of bigger businesses can provide this if they want to sort of compete for workers, but how it would help make this kind of leave accessible for both all workers and also all small businesses.
Chair Richardson, or would you like your testifier to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be great if Ms. Noreen could comment.
Ms. Noreen. I don't know if she's
Mr. Chair, not hearing, yeah. Not hearing from her. I think what I would just say that, we talk a lot about leveling the playing field within the presentation of this bill, because we know that for many larger entities, they are much more likely to have access to paid family medical leave programs than smaller businesses as well. And so really the concept around this is really being able to sort of pull together to create a safety net that is going to catch the majority of Minnesotans. And right now for small businesses, they don't have that opportunity to really compete in terms of from a benefits perspective as it relates to paid family medical leave in the same way that large employers do. And when we think about not only the sort of the ability of a program like this to address equity issues, to ensure that more lower income Minnesotans have the ability to care for their families and for themselves when they need to do that. But it also provides an opportunity to really be able to create a program that is sustainable for smaller businesses to be able to really have more competitive benefits and to be much more attractive to workers as well.
Jim Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Richardson. I strongly support this policy, and I really appreciate all of the ways that I think it'll help the different parts of our economy and workers and families. So thank you.
Ms. Shawhorst, this is normally member question time. Real brief comment, please.
I just wanted to say that on behalf of the chamber, a majority of our members are small and mid-sized businesses. So I can't speak on behalf of the Main Street Alliance business members, but on the one-page document, we had joined with a number of employer organizations that do consist of a number of small businesses in opposition to this bill because of the fact that it's a one-size-fits-all mandate, and a number of our members provide benefits on these topics in a creative way that address the needs of their particular workforce. And under the way that the bill is written, they would not be able to maintain those benefits and would instead be obligated to pay for the program as designed by the bill. So like I said, I'm not gonna speak on behalf of the Main Street Alliance business members, but our organization does consist of majority of small business size members. And this is the message that they do carry on behalf of themselves today. Thank you.
Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill. To go to Lauren, I guess, and I don't necessarily have a question, but I was reading in California as I was preparing, we were hearing the bill. California had several business journals that actually spoke about the benefits for smaller businesses. So I find that interesting. So I would like to connect with you offline. Representative Richardson, this is a great bill, and I think it's a really important conversation. I was impacted by this when I had my twins who were premature. I was a clinical therapist who had my twins 4 months early, and trying to find leave was really complicated. I was just lucky that I had a husband that could help me with paying the bills. And not everybody has that. I grew up to a single mom. And so you start thinking about what that looks like for all Minnesotans. We know that women who take paid family leave and who are offered it are more likely to stay in the workforce. And they're 54% more likely to report a wage increase. We look at the wage gap. So I imagine that this Representative Richardson helps with that wage gap. Have you found any of that in your work on this bill?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Edelson, for the question. And I think it's really important because you lift up an important equity piece here. We know that even with the lowest income workers that are within two-parent households, they are oftentimes one or two paychecks away from financial disaster if something, if something occurs. And so, what the research and data really shows is that if people are able to work and care for their families and have access to paid family leave, they are more likely to stay within the workforce. Because when people are pushed out, like the testifier that we heard of today, when we see our lowest income workers being three times more likely to take leave or to lose their job when they take leave, what that really means is then they are in a position of having to try to find another job, which is going to take time, which is also going to be an economic impact for them as well. And I think what's really important when we think through the process of this in terms of the deep inequities and disparities that we see in terms of who has access and who doesn't, the discretion that we have around paid family leave is really part of the disparities piece, because so often the disparities grow and breed within the discretion, because we have, when you look at who has access to paid family leave, it's oftentimes individuals who are earning higher incomes, who are working at larger businesses, as compared with like lower income workers or individuals who are working within smaller businesses as well. And, we've had a number of small businesses testify across many different committees, including the Commerce Committee as well. And a number of small businesses are saying, we need this, it's long overdue, because it is going to not only help their businesses to retain employees, but it's going to ensure that individuals are not in that position of having to say, am I going to care for myself, or am I going to get a paycheck? And I think it's really important to like recognize within this as well, when you look at the research and data in terms of, for those who have access to leave right now, only about 13% of people who have access to leave right now take that. So on an annual basis, about 13% of employees take leave. And the average leave is 6.6 weeks. Again, Minnesotans are hardworking. They want to work hard, but they want to also be able to take care of their families.
Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. That's really helpful. And I just want to thank members for the discussion today. The other thing I just wanted to point out, which I found surprising to our committee, is when I was reading about it, that the U.S. ranks last in paid leave for new parents in the U.S. So around the country. And we're like one of the only industrialized countries that really is not doing great in this area. So I just thank everybody for the discussion.
Representative Berg, and before we go, members, we have 13 minutes left in committee. We will be voting at 4:27. So I'm going to go through the members that haven't asked questions, and we'll see if we'll get to the other two back. Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll make this brief. This is a sort of a statement to the broader committee here. I think effective legislators, we often run rooted in our life experience, and that what makes us good at this job, but I also think it's our responsibility to step outside of our own lived experience. So I'm grateful that many of you don't know what this is like. Many of you have never had to make this choice. But I would really sort of challenge you
to try to feel what that might be like for a worker that lives pay to paycheck, and see if you can sort of walk a mile in their shoes and understand why this is essential. You know, I'm not a vet, but I fight hard for vet issues because I believe in it. This is something that actually ensures that not only our small businesses, but our economy at large works, because when you take care of your employees, they're happy, they work harder, and we all succeed that way. So as you're sort of battling over how much this is going to cost, I would challenge you to ask yourselves what the cost of humanity is, being a human being. Thank you, Chair Richardson, for bringing this legislation forward. It is long overdue and so incredibly necessary.
Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just piggybacking on what Representative Berg says, I would ask that you walk a mile in some small business owner's shoes. You know, we struggle. We put our lives into these business, and we do take care of our employees. But to the author, have you given any thought to the micro employers out there, the employers with maybe two, maybe three employees, maybe even one? You know, if we don't have the flexibility of dealing with these people on a personal basis and making decisions based on our business and their needs, how is that going to help the employee? If I have a business model that allows for 40 to 60 hours of paid help, and I have to get let someone go for 12 to 24 weeks, then I have to bring someone else in, and then I have to let that person go when the other one comes back, versus letting me deal with that on a personal basis with the employee. How does that help the small businesses?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bliss, for the question. So in terms of independent contractors and sole proprietors, the way that the bill is drafted is they have the ability to opt in into the program. And in terms of the challenges that all businesses face, be they large businesses or small businesses, when there's an illness or an accident, there's a new child being born, we know right now that businesses have to be within a position to find individuals to provide that coverage. So in terms of the challenges that we see around providing that coverage, that exists right now without this bill. But one of the things that I think would be very helpful to small businesses as well, because with this pooled approach, what that would mean is it would actually free up dollars within the business to be able to bring in someone to cover for a period of time.
Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, have you hired anybody lately? Do you know what the job market is out there? I have lots of friends in small businesses that can't find employees. They cannot find employees. So you're telling me that this frees up money to find an employee. If you can tell me where these employees are, I would be happy to let my small business owner friends know. I really don't have any more questions, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments. The comment was made that we're comparing ourselves to California, that it's helping the small businesses out there. From what I know about California, they're losing their businesses in droves right now. So I don't know if we want to compare ourselves to California. And to the author, we need to really give the small businesses flexibility now coming out of the pandemic. We want to hire people. We want to treat them right, but this is just not the time to do this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair
Richardson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bliss, for the question. Yes, I have hired people recently. I oversee right now 117 staff people. So I'm very familiar with the challenges that are faced in terms of finding individuals, particularly within the medical field, with COVID as well. So I can definitely relate to those challenges.
Okay, we have 5 minutes before we vote. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be succinct. Quick question for Chair Richardson. One of your testifiers said earlier that 75% of Minnesotans don't have access to family care leave, and then you referred to that as well, even though we have FMLA and the federal version of that. So I'm wondering, where did you get that number? That seems awful high, that 75% does not have access to that. So that's the first question. Second question is, what you said you had bipartisan support in the Senate. I'd be curious what Republicans are going to sign on to this very large and expensive bill. And let's see. Thirdly, using unemployment insurance, it's the federal government is very clear to use UI in this manner that you are for resources is against federal policy and law. So you might want to look into that. We had this issue a week and a half ago, I think Representative Frazier's bill, where he's going to use unemployment insurance for resources for his bill, and that is against federal law. So you might want to look into that. So if you could refer to those two questions, the 75%, maybe it's less, but that's the number that I heard. And then the other part is what bipartisan support you had in the Senate. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Chair Eklund, and thank you, Representative McDonald, for the question. So when it comes to FMLA, FMLA exempts employers with under 50 employees. So that is definitely one of the reasons that we tend to see that within smaller businesses and for individuals who are of the lowest income are not having access to leave under that FMLA program. And again, FMLA is unpaid leave. It's not a paid leave. And in terms of the research, there is really great research that's been put together, not only by the University of Minnesota, but Ms. Fitzpatrick was also part of a work group that put together some of the research and data around the workforce issues that we continue to see. And I think it's really important that we continue to stress that the individuals who don't have the access to paid family leave are typically the most economically insecure within our communities as well. So it's the lowest income workers, it's Black, Indigenous, and Latinx and other workers of color, and oftentimes it's women that are disproportionately impacted as well. And in terms of the bipartisan support within the Senate, Chair Bach has signed on to the bill.
Fascinating.
Representative Detmer. Quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that I just wanted to clarify that I'm looking at the Senate. You got Kent, Senator Kent, Port, Champion, Putman, and Bach. And I guess Bach is independent, so I guess you can say it's bipartisan. I just wanted to clarify that.
Seeing no other member questions, members, I think this is a terrific bill. Thank you, Chair Richardson, for bringing it. It's about time that Minnesota moves into taking care of their workers with paid family medical leave. Final comments, Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present this bill. I think that within the outcomes of the COVID pandemic, we know that we've had to step up to support businesses within this, and we also need to step up to support families as well, because hardworking Minnesotans deserve a safety net. And with that, I would just ask for member support.
I will renew my motion that House File 1200 be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Aye.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Nay.
Detmer, nay. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, no.
McDonald, no. Representative Berg.
Absolutely.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
No.
Bliss, no. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston, excused. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, nay.
Raleigh, no. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. There are 8 ayes, 4 nays.
8 ayes and 4 nays. You're on your way to Health, Finance, and Policy, Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members and staff, our next meeting is tomorrow, Wednesday, March 17th. Any questions or further comments? We have about a minute.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
I would just like to compliment Representative Richardson. I think she did a very good job presenting her bill and answering the questions, and I'm very impressed with her legislative work. So I'm not always that mean, you know. Nice.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative McDonald. Any other questions or comments? If not, we are adjourned.